Walton as our speaker. I just want to comment a little bit. Many of you know of Lewis. You know him or you have read his books, but he is a tax lawyer. He works in Los Angeles as a tax attorney, has a degree magna cum laude from law school, has a JD degree. Subsequently to that, he worked in with a diplomat in tax law, which ended up with an LLM. And for those of you who know tax, that's about as high as you can go in the world of tax. He followed that, however, by study of the European common law, European community of common law at Oxford University. And he has made religious liberty and issues related to scriptural and spiritual things a major part of his life. And it's my privilege to welcome Lewis Walton to be here with us to speak at this time. Now, I just want to make one other mention. This afternoon, right after potluck, we will continue with two more sessions. You're not going to want to miss those. And some have asked about the tapes. We will, anybody will be able to go onto our Fallbrook Church website and listen to the audio of these presentations, just like we do all of our other presentations. There will be CDs if someone wants to get a CD. And you see we have DV production going on, and you'll be able to purchase those. All the details will be on the Fallbrook Church website. So if you'd like to know, if you want to get a copy of these to share with someone, you'll be able to do that. Lewis, we're delighted to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Dan. And in this age of evident conflict of interest in high places, I should disclaim I have absolutely no economic connection with this weekend, whatever. And wow, what a beautiful service. You know, this proves that a traditional worship service doesn't have to be user unfriendly. Thank you for the fellowship here. Thank you for the energy I feel in this room. And thanks for the good music. Sonia's beautiful music, and Art can sure play a horn, can't he? You know, had I known, I would have brought my trombone down. We would have had a whole trombone section. And, you know, from time to time, we could have moved from right to left. You know how they do it. Next time, I'll bring it. Okay, but I really have enjoyed being here, and what a great group of kids you have. Outstanding church. Well, the Lord is here, and it's just a pleasure to be here. Many years ago, toward the end of World War II, there was a young junior officer on the bridge of a warship, standing watch in the evening. The captain had gone below to his underway cabin, and everything seemed to be going reasonably well in the shallow waters of Chesapeake Bay, when suddenly there was that unmistakable, unforgettable, heart-stopping, career-ending whump. And the ship suddenly stopped, rocked a little from side to side as the bow dug in. They were aground. The young man was just drawing a breath to say something when the captain burst onto the bridge, began giving orders. I have the con. Quartermaster, what's your heading? Very well, rudder amidships, engines back one. Messenger, pipe the damage control officer to the bridge on the double. Quartermaster, get me around the bearings, I mean right now. And the replies came back, midship's eye, engines back one confirmed, round the bearings right now, sir. Not on the bridge wings, Elladade swung to line up with a lighthouse and the winking lights of a broadcast tower, and off illumined in the shore light was the abutment of a bridge. And the lines of bearing from those shoreside positions were brought in, laid down on the chart. And bingo, there it was, perfect three-line fix, right over that telltale hump in the floor of the ocean, marked shoal water. Captain turned to the young officer and he said, "Mister, were you surprised by this?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, then I got a question for you. Why?" It was right there on the chart. Well, a few weeks ago, that now seem like several lifetimes, we felt that unmistakable, heart-stopping, career-ending whoomp as the world economy went aground. I mean, world economy. And the question I pose to you this morning is, were you surprised? And if so, then I ask you why. It was right there on the chart. Let's open the Word. Turn with me, if you will, to Revelation chapter 18. 18, verse 1. Real easy to find. Last book in the Bible. 18th chapter, first verse. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen and has become a dwelling place of demons. I'm reading this morning from the New King James Version. Now, what we're about to read here is one of the few passages in the Bible that even hints at an economic forecast at the end of time. You go researching in the Bible, you'll find there's an awful lot in there about wealth as a diagnostic tool to our spirituality. Lots in there about how we handle wealth. There is very, very little about economic predictions, treating economics as an abstract academic subject. Almost nothing in there. And that's not terribly surprising to me for a couple of reasons. Number one, a place like heaven, where they use gold for pavement, isn't easily impressed with a Dow Jones average. There's a more important reason. The Bible wasn't intended to be used as a spiritual Dun and Bradstreet source. And as a result, the Bible simply pretty much leaves the topic alone. It's aloof. It's almost above it. Well, almost above and almost alone. Because in a very few places, you get hints that just before Jesus returns, there will be an economic collapse on a massive global scale, on a world-shaking scale. And Revelation 18 is one of those places that kind of hints at it. We draw between the dots and we begin to get the picture. So now let's go back to Revelation 18. Take a look at verse 11. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones, silk and scarlet, every kind of object. All the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more. And the merchants who became rich by her will stand at a distance, verse 15, weeping and wailing and saying, Alas, alas, for that great city, verse 17, for in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing. Now, in the Greek, what you're looking at here for 1 hour is basically this. The Greek word ora. What it means is a very brief, indeterminate period of time. Doesn't last long. In other words, whatever happens here happens fast. Now, in a moment, we're going to talk about the current economic crisis, and I don't want to go further than we safely can in interpreting current events and prophecy, because that's always risky. But bearing in mind that I'm not identifying this as being the Revelation 18 fulfillment, nonetheless, do you remember how quickly events happened just as autumn was beginning to turn leaves last year? And we went from an economy where they were hoping we might show still some positive economic gain to one where suddenly the world's in panic mode. Didn't take long, just a period of basically a few days. So in 1 hour, such great riches came to nothing. Well, let's go back now to verse 17, and as we do, focus in on the obvious global implications of this thing. It apparently describes something where world trade has gone awry, and as we read about ship captains and merchants on the sea recognize that most of global commerce today travels by sea. We move people by air, we move packages of urgent importance by air, but the great bulk of world commerce travels by sea. So back now to verse 17 of Revelation 18. Every shipmaster, all who travel by ship, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out, weeping and wailing, Alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich. For in 1 hour she is made desolate. global economic disaster. There's just no other way to read that portion of Revelation 18. Now, compare that, if you will, with the book of James. Kind of keep your finger in Revelation because we'll be going back there. But turn back to the book of James. Find the fifth chapter in the first verse. James 5:1. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Verse 3, your gold and silver are corroded. Some versions say rusted. And hang on just a second. Your gold and silver are what? Corroded? Wait a minute. These metals here don't rust. Okay? Silver may tarnish. All a housewife has to do is put a little something on there, wipe it off, and it's as good as new. A little bit of oxide comes off, but the metal isn't rusting. This stuff here is just almost chemically non-reactive. You can burn it if you want to with a mixture of two very powerful acids, but other than that, gold simply doesn't react. It is so non-reactive that when we set our first space vehicles up in the 50s, we didn't know what was out there. Maybe there's something caustic out there. So we covered our early satellites with gold. They were gold-plated. On the theory, if there's anything caustic out there, gold will survive it. So now James comes along and says, this stuff is suddenly rusting. That is chemically impossible. It cannot happen unless what? Unless the rules of chemistry change. Or to put it another way, unless the rules of economics that we always relied on suddenly don't work anymore. This is obviously an end time prophecy because go back to verse 3 of James 5. How does it end here? You have heaped up treasures in the what? Last days. Economic collapse at the end of time. Now the Bible hints at it. Just obliquely in a very few places. So let's go to another source that I happen personally to also consider to be inspired. And perhaps I better ask you at this point, are we brave enough in this church to quote the spirit of prophecy? Let me tell you a little story. A number of years ago, a couple of Mormon missionaries came by my house. And by the way, when I see those clean-cut, well-groomed young men with shirts and ties on, given 2 years of their lives just because they believe in their faith. And not in a car either, on the backs of bicycles. I sometimes feel just a little envious. They said, would you like to come to our local steak next Sunday? I said, sure, I'll come over. I did. I went to a Mormon church. Now, when I went in there, I went in wanting and expecting to hear about the Hill Cumorah and the Celestial Kingdom and the Word of Wisdom, which, by the way, is astonishingly similar to our health message. I wanted to hear about the Book of Mormon. I wanted to hear about Joseph Smith. I would have been upset if, because they perceived a Gentile was there, they suddenly didn't say anything about their unique faith. I wanted to hear about Joseph Smith. Why? Because I was in a Mormon church. Well, this is an Adventist church, isn't it? So I'm going to quote from the Spirit of Prophecy. Turn, if you will, in your mind to a familiar quote from Volume 9. You can turn there because hopefully you've read it. If you haven't, I encourage you to do so. Volume 9 of the Testimonies for the Church, page 13. Those who hold the reins of government are not able to solve the problem of moral corruption, poverty, pauperism, and increasing crime. They are struggling in vain to place the business operations on a more secure basis. End of quote. Wait a second, you just convinced me. That woman was a plagiarist. She copied that. And you know from where? New York Times, 2009. She, too, says very little about the end-time global economy. She says an awful lot, like the Bible does, about properly managing money, responsibly managing it, and using it as a diagnostic tool for one's spiritual welfare. But once in a while, from her writings, we also get a hint something's out there waiting for us in the future. And another example of that is found in the book Christian Service, page 158. Let me read it to you. The work which the church has failed to do in a time of peace and prosperity, she will have to do in a terrible crisis under the most discouraging, forbidding circumstances. Christian Service, 158. All right, now let's just do a little elementary logic. Church could have done it in a time of peace and prosperity, but that time ends, and discouraging circumstances enter in, which logically tell us what? That prosperity has disappeared. Now let me ask a question. Is all of this beginning to sound just a little bit reminiscent of the world we live in? There's not much there, but what is there is graphic. And it suggests associated with end-time events is an economic problem. All right, the question that we next face is, what do we do with this information? How do we handle a current economic crisis that our world is in and prophecy? In other words, what interpretation do we put on this? I think it would be irresponsible for people who are so clear in biblical and other inspired sources not to at least look at what's happening in the world and begin to say, is heaven trying to tell us something? Is heaven acting out a drama here that we should begin to recognize? And bear in mind, as you try to link up current events with prophecy, there's a certain lag, there's a certain lead time. You have to be very careful about it, because I've often said we're very much like passengers riding facing rearward in the observation car of a train. Remember trains where they used to have that old car in the back with windows around the back? You could face rearward, and you could see the track disappearing behind you. You had a very clear view of where you had been. You had a reasonable view and peripheral vision of where you were, and you had no idea where you were going. Okay? So as we interpret prophecy, we have to be responsible and not try to draw the lines further than we're really able to do with our database. That said, what interpretation can we put on what's happening in the world today? Well, some would be tempted to say, and understandably tempted to say, this is it. You know, it can't get any worse than this. This has to be the end or very near to it. And the caution I would extend there is we need to be careful. It's always risky to be dogmatic about the Advent simply because the Advent is what? The Advent is conditional. Conditional on what? Conditional on God's people doing what we were put here to do. My take on the world today is human history is far readier for the Advent than we are. It's 10 months pregnant. It's wanting to give birth. Where are we? So the Advent is conditional, to some extent at least, on God's people doing what they were put here to do. Now, sure, the time may come when the Advent message is preached by stones and angels. That could happen. Heaven may get that desperate. And it may be sooner than we think it is. But meanwhile, heaven has given us a job to do. Now, what's our job? Well, for those of you who are here in the first service, we talked about that. What we're here to do, in my opinion, is to give the messages of Revelation 14, 6 through 12. That's a clear stair step, escalating progression toward the Advent, which starts with the preaching of the gospel, goes through the judgment hour message and the Sabbath and the fall of Babylon and the patience of the saints and the keeping of commandments and leads to the faith of Jesus. And once you reach Revelation 14, 12, in just two verses, the whole eastern sky is ablaze and the cosmic king is here. So that's the progression of events that I think heaven's waiting for, and the Advent is, in many ways, contingent on God's people delivering those messages. So, we're here to give the messages of Revelation 14, and until we do, we could be here a while, enjoying mosquitoes, salmonella, economic recession, and the IRS. Not a very user-friendly world. So my caution is, let's don't be dogmatic about predicting the end until we see real revival and reformation in the church. Then you can be looking for it. Well, others may say the opposite. There's another extreme you could take. You'd say, this current economic recession doesn't really have significance, it doesn't mean anything, because Revelation 13 predicts America as being an economic powerhouse at the end of time, able to dictate economic policy to the world, including a buy-sell, or we might call it in today's language, an embargo on the nonconformist. Before we just totally write off the current economic depression as having little significance, there are a couple things we need to consider. That ignores a profound economic reality, and that is this. I'm speaking to you from the world of business. From my window on the 14th floor overlooking Wilshire Boulevard, I see this thing up pretty close. America may speak with Revelation 13 authority to the world simply because they can't afford to ignore us. Let me tell you why. Our debt to nations right now, such as China, Saudi Arabia, and the Middle East, is so staggering that if we fail, their investments in the U.S. come down too. If we fail, the world comes down with us. There is almost no power scarier than the power of a bankrupt debtor. So one possibility is America can speak with real authority economically at the end of time simply because they can't afford to ignore us. The other possibility is this economic crisis may have more to do with the end of time than some realize, because it touches everybody. It not just vicariously like 9/11 did. 9/11 hurt us collectively. We all felt bad. We felt outraged. We felt violated. But very few of us had direct contacts with those 3,000-some people in New York or the Pentagon or Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Our contact was reasonably proximate. When we got the call that terrible morning that the Pentagon was being attacked, I tried to call my son because he lived right up the hill from the Pentagon. I couldn't get through. The cell phone towers were all jammed. A friend of his up at PUC called, said, "Don't worry about Rich. He's okay. I got through to him, but he sounds like he's directing traffic." Well, he was. He was at the Pentagon. He ran down the hill, joined up with Marines coming out of Henderson Hall, which is headquarters of the United States Marine Corps, went down, went to the southwest wedge. The guard at that door, which is usually heavily locked, had it wide open and was just beckoning him in. And Rich and those Marines were some of the first volunteers inside the building. Rich, by the time the day was open, said, I didn't realize it at the time, but my arms were burned. But very few of us had any real loss from 9/11. That was something that we collectively felt, and we felt outraged. And we got a sense of catharsis as our nation began to do something about it. But pain, even on that scale, tends over time to kind of self-correct, and we got over it. Where you've got an economic depression that just goes on and on and hurts right where it counts, right in your pocketbook. This thing has the capacity to hurt everybody and go on hurting longer than people can stand. And finally, desperate people come to the point where they're willing to throw liberty away for the sake of what? Hopefully getting back to the good times. That, in my opinion, is where this rascal comes in, your national identity card, with all your information, including all your past tax returns, your health information, your driver's license, your union card, if you've got one, your registration to vote, all of it encrypted on this thing. You don't have that. You can't operate the cash register because this becomes the sole medium for the transmission of wealth. In a hyperinflationary economy, where the government is desperate to get inflation under control and finally tries to put on price controls, unless you control everything at the cash register, you are incapable of controlling an underground economy where people otherwise can run inflation up. Okay? So what I'm saying is that basically, I see more danger now from economic collapse over the long term than I do from isolated attacks of terrorism. And I say that recognizing it's very, very difficult to be dogmatic about fulfillment of prophecy. All we can do at the very best is speculate. Anyway, whatever interpretation you choose to put on the current economic crisis, let me assure you the thing has the capacity to get very ugly. I'm, as Dan said, a tax trial attorney in downtown L.A. I've got a pretty close view on a lot of what is going on. I'll talk much more about it this afternoon. I'll give you facts, figures, some charts and graphs to let you have an idea where we are and where the thing is taking us, and then spiritually how we react to that. But for this morning, let me just share with you a little bit of what should cause us some concern. Commentators have repeatedly said this could be the worst depression since the 1930s. I'll tell you, from where I sit, what we see today could make the 1930s look like the good old days. Let's talk just briefly about the 1930s, more this afternoon, but a few comparisons here. Then, there was no globally threatening housing crisis. This housing crisis in America, as I'll show you this afternoon, threatens to pull down the economy of China and much of the Middle East. It's just that serious. Then we didn't have it, now we do. Then, there were no credit cards. Now, the average person has 13 of them, and consumer debt is $1.7 trillion. Then the banking crisis was not so globally integrated. This afternoon, I'll give you a little more information here, but the banking system in the world is very much like an inverted pyramid, and of every dollar you put into it, only 6 cents is actually kept in the bank. This stuff gets transferred from bank to bank to bank to bank, and pretty soon you've got this enormous pyramid resting on you, and it's worth 6 cents. What makes it work? Can it work? Sure. It's produced the most incredible wealth in the history of the world. This system can work. What's the weak link? The weak link is right here. You lose trust in this system, and that pyramid tumbles. Okay. Two or three more comparisons. The 1930s. Then the everything was made in America. Now go to Home Depot and try to find anything that is. I'm talking tools, garden hose, table lamps, even light bulbs. I bought some light bulbs the other day. Took them home. My wife, I put it in her light for her nightstand. She said, you know, this thing doesn't seem like it's quite right. I pulled it out. It was supposed to be 100 watt. It wasn't delivering anything like that. I looked on the top of the bulb. Sure enough, made in China. Then the United States lent to the world. Now, Saudi Arabia has $800 billion of our debt. The entire Middle East, $3,500 billion. China, $900 billion. Let me say it plainly. This ain't the 1930s. We don't have the reserve we then did. Oh, there's one other thing. Back in the 1930s, one morning, the associate treasurer of the General Conference woke up. Associate treasurer, mind you, not the treasurer, an underling. Woke up and felt compelled to go to New York. No authority, no direction from upstairs. Nobody told him to do it. He just did it. Got on the train with an empty satchel. Went up to New York City. Went to the church's bank. And he said, I'm drawing out the account. Give it all to me. In cash? Yes, sir. They put it in the satchel. He made it alive out of New York with that much money in his hands. Got back on the train, went back to Washington, went to bed. Satchel under his seat. Next morning, he went to the general conference. As he walked down the street, he passed newspapers on the newspaper stands with headlines, "Banks Closed." Went into the GC offices. The brethren were there in crisis mode. "We lost our money. How are we going to pay the missionaries? How are we going to pay the pastors? How are we going to fund the publishing work?" And that associate treasurer put his satchel on the table and told about as remarkable a story as anybody had ever heard. See, the Lord was watching out for his church, even if he had to bypass the GC committee, general conference president, ADCOM, PREXAD, even the senior treasurer, and go looking for an underling who was responsive to the promptings of the Holy Spirit. Oh, say, I don't know the answer to this. How did the church do this time? Did we lose anything in the stock market? I hope not. I don't know the answer. I'm not in that loop. But the question fascinates me. Much more this afternoon. But this morning, I pose a question now. Is there anything we should be learning from this crisis? Practical, spiritual issues we could learn. We just did a comparison between the 1930s and the present. Now I propose to do another comparison between what went wrong in the world and what we knew all along that, if followed, could have prevented the problem. Because it could have. What went wrong in the world? Number one, speculation. Actually, two words, speculation and greed, but the two usually fuse nicely together. It's just almost like a common term. Wild speculation on the part of home buyers. I know I can't afford it, but when the adjustable rate mortgage cranks up, maybe I'll have gotten a raise. Speculation on the part of lenders. Sure, these people can't afford it, but there's always Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Or as one confused newscaster recently said, Fannie Mac and Freddie Mae. I represented a lender back in the good old days. I saved him so much on an IRS audit, he went out and bought a jet with the refund he got. I'm not sure today he's even still in business. He was in the home loan business. The bubble was so huge, you could see right through it. Now, what about us? That's where the world went wrong. Did we have any advice on speculation? Well, let me share you one thing from Volume 2 of the Testimonies, page 665. Talking about believers who get beguiled into speculation. The prospect of getting more money fast and easily allures them. They reason that although they had resolved to put this money into the treasury of God, they will greatly increase it and then give a larger sum to the cause. They can see no possibility of failure. Away goes the means out of their hands, and they soon learn to their regret. They've made a mistake. The brilliant prospects have faded. Satan outgeneraled them. He managed to get their means into his ranks and deprive the cause of God which should have been used in extending the truth. Speculation. What is speculation? It's unreasonable risk-taking. There's risk in everything we do. Whenever we put the key in the car and head down the road, there's risk there. What I'm talking about is unreasonable risk-taking. This has been a problem, even among God's people, from the 1850s on, because in 1857, James White published an editorial in the Review that so energized the church with revival and reformation, it almost led to the Second Coming. You can read about that in Volume 2 if you want to. I think it's Volume 2. Anyway, Ellen White said heaven was gearing up. It looked as if the Second Coming could happen. And then God's people got involved in a lot of speculative investment, particularly in mining stock back in that era. And the crest of the revival came down the other side and plunged right into the awful era of the Civil War. And it would be another 40 years before we had that kind of opportunity again. Speculation. Point number two. Unnecessary accumulation of wealth. I'm thinking of houses and lands that now lie block after block undeveloped. I also represented home builders back there, real estate developers who are now considering bankruptcy. Did we have any advice on the unnecessary accumulation of wealth? Well, doesn't the Bible give us some good example about not putting our money into whole bags with holes in them? What about the rich man's soul, take thy ease? You got it made. What about the rich young ruler willing to give up heaven because he couldn't turn loose of earthly junk? What about the spirit of prophecy? Country Living, page 14. An expensive dwelling, elaborate furnishings, display, luxury, and ease do not furnish the conditions essential to a happy, useful life. Jesus came to this earth to accomplish the greatest work ever accomplished. What were the conditions chosen by the Father for his Son? A secluded home in the Galilean hills. A household sustained by honest, self-respecting labor. A life of simplicity, daily conflict with difficulty. Economy, patient, gladsome service. The hour of study at his mother's side with the open roll of scripture. And by the way, at the side of the knee of Mary. He learned enough to confuse the Sanhedrin when he met them at the age of 12. Says something about homeschooling done right, doesn't it? Well, that was the kind of life that the Father chose for his Son. How can we do better? So much for lifestyle in ordinary times. What about as the end of time draws near? Then, I think accumulation of wealth in a dying world is very much like somebody on the Titanic, where the deck is already listing 10 degrees, calling the steward in and saying, you know, the color on this wall, on this bulkhead is entirely unsatisfactory. I want it repainted. Here's one from Councils on Stewardship. Kind of interesting little quote, page 59. Houses and lands will be of no use to the saints in the time of trouble, for they will then have to flee, and at that time their possessions cannot be disposed of to advance the cause of present truth. It is the will of God the saints should cut loose from every encumbrance before the time of trouble comes and make a covenant of God through sacrifice. If they have property on the altar and earnestly inquire of God, he will teach them when to dispose of it. Then they will be free. Now, let me stop here and issue a really, really serious caveat. I hope nobody goes home today, says, Mama, did you hear what Walton said? Let's sell a house. Don't move emotionally and carelessly. What does she say? If you put your property on the altar, the Lord will lead you. Let the Lord lead you. Don't run off and do something hysterically and irresponsibly. Very, very important that Adventists don't fall into the trap, the attractive trap of extremism. I'm always disappointed when I speak at Adventist congregations and I have people involved not in present truth, not in the Revelation 14 messages, but some hot new theory on conspiracy. Where does that lead us? There may be a conspiracy. Let it conspire. We have the gospel to preach. I was at a church recently where some guys came up to me and said, hey, you know, there was no airplane hit the Pentagon. We got the whole scoop right here on this CD. Well, I got news for you, fellas. My son was at the Pentagon, and here's a picture of a piece of the airplane sitting out where the helipad was. I've been through this many times. It has obvious American Airlines markings on it, along with a lot of aircraft debris. Sure, the hole was small when the airplane first went in. That wedge of the Pentagon had just been remodeled. There were windows right near the detonation site that didn't even break because the glass was so strong. What I'm begging us to do as Adventists is let's stay in the Word. Let's stay with responsible truth. There is so much truth here, we don't have to explore far-flung theories. That's my plea. So, and especially as we plan the management of our finances, please, let us allow the Lord to lead. Let him lead. But let's be aware of his leading and recognizing there's not a long future on this world. Now, for church leaders, apparently this kind of advice is extremely serious and has sobering implications if church leadership fails. Volume 2 puts it this way. She was talking to some church leaders. She said, notwithstanding the repeated warnings which the Lord has sent them, those who have occupied responsible positions in the church have followed their own unsanctified judgment. The cause of God has suffered. All who were thus guilty will have a fearful record to meet. If they are ever saved, it will be by no common effort on their part. That's in chapter 61 in a section called Addresses to Ministers. That's one reason why I respect the gospel ministry so highly. That's a huge burden to carry. Any individual who feels called, and you better feel called to do it, has my highest admiration, because that's a level of responsibility I'm not sure I'd be comfortable carrying. But you know something? We as lay people carry a fairly high level of responsibility for stewardship ourselves. Review and Herald, she put it this way, I was shown that as the work was closing up and the truth was going forth in mighty power, rich men will bring their means, lay it at the feet of the servants of God, begging them to accept it. The answer from the servants of God is, your means are not needed. Now, wait a second. Have you ever known the brethren to refuse a gift? It just doesn't happen. Something's gone wrong here that's made money useless. This stuff has defied the laws of chemistry, and it's turned to rust. Okay? So as the Lord gives us guidance, I think it's wise if we can be particularly sensitive to it. Finally, before it's over, we need to remember that we're the only generation in the history of the world of which God asks everything. Before this drama ends, we will have left nothing tying us to earth. But as we wait for God's deliverance in his own good time, we should live well but simply. How should we live? Well, we've got advice on this. We just read some, how the Father chose the life of Jesus early on in quiet country living. Another place we're told that fathers and mothers who possess a piece of land and a comfortable home are kings and queens. Notice a comfortable home. There's no reason why we have to make ourselves miserable. A comfortable home and a piece of land. A simple economical home life blessed by hard work, by challenge, and preferably in the country. Now, that's not always possible. That's a goal I think all of us have, ultimately. Not always easy to do. But our goal should be as simple a life as possible here. Why? Because our goal is getting off this earth, not acquiring more of it. Now, what's my point? Simply by following the few passages of advice I've just read, out of thousands that we could read, we could have avoided the very reef on which the world economy just went aground. I'm still working despite my obvious decrepitude. I go home on weekends, but every day I drive across the L.A. basin to work. And every day when I drive, I think about that quiet country home that Joe and I bought 30 years ago, with its faithful water springs, giving us pure water even in drought, and starry eyes, starry nights, and clear air of daylight. In the good soil and the joy of dinner less than an hour out of the garden. You know something? I wouldn't trade that 30 acres for all of L.A. We got it not because we were smart enough to see 2009 coming. We got it just because we believed the spirit of prophecy. How many dangers, both spiritual and physical, we could lessen if only we would bother to read at least as far as volume 2. Now, that doesn't mean we won't get hurt. We're still deep in enemy territory here. We're deep in a war zone in this world. There's going to be lost jobs and mortgages we undertook in all good faith that are now just too much to carry. There are going to be kids and grandkids who face hard times. The end of time is not an easy era in which to live. But you know something? Every prophet who ever lived would have traded everything to trade places with us. Is this economic crisis the end of the world? I think it's more likely a wake-up call, just like 9/11 was supposed to be. I thought back then, there's no way God's people will sleep through this. But we did. After all, 9/11 was something far away, and our good California life went on, and we flew our flags and thumped our chests and cheered our military as they went into Afghanistan and Iraq, and then, as always, they did magnificently. And the Dow rebounded through 10,000 and into the teens, and home prices soared like a rocket, and if you knew how to play the real estate game, you could get very, very rich. Until one autumn day, when the ship suddenly stopped moving, and there was a heart-stopping, unmistakable, career-ending whump, and the world economy ran aground. And as we close, I got a question for you. Were you surprised? If so, why? It was right there on the chart.